Welcome to PostStatus Draft, the official podcast for PostStatus, a website with news and information for WordPress professionals. Today, Joe and I talk about the WordPress REST API, which was just merged into the development version of WordPress Core and will be part of WordPress 4.7. It's been a long journey, and we discuss the process so far, what's next, and a variety of topics around the new API. If you enjoy this podcast, you can get a lot more quality news and analysis from the PostStatus Club multiple times per week. Check out our current club members, site partners, and join the club on our website at poststatus.com/club. You'll be joining more than 750 wonderful club members, and you'll never miss important WordPress news again. Also, take a look at PostStatus Publish. You can go to poststatus.com/publish and check out this conference that's for PostStatus members on December 1st in Philadelphia. I think you'll have a great time. Today, I'd like to feature one of our partners, Opt-in Monster. Opt-in Monster helps you convert visitors into subscribers with six different styles of lead capture forms. Opt-in Monster is already built to be well within Google's new mobile-friendly guidelines. You can learn more about Opt-in Monster at optinmonster.com, and thanks to Opt-in Monster for being a PostStatus partner. Now, here's our show. Hey, everybody. I'm Brian, and I'm the editor of PostStatus.
And I'm Joe, a co-founder and the CTO of HumanMade, and welcome to the PostStatus Draft Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about the WordPress REST API and its merge into Core.
Woohoo! Yeah, so only a few years coming. So WordPress 4.7 is underway in development. And what is the point of development that this would be called that we're coming up to, the feature freeze?
Yeah, I guess it's the feature freeze. So, like, the merge window is what Core usually calls it.
Yeah,
which is
feature freeze is actually when beta comes out, right?
Yes. So, I mean, there's not much time in between anyway. I think there's only a week in between those two points. So it's like all of the feature projects that have been developed, you know, they're already, you know, going now.
I see.
And should be kind of now just iterating and fixing things until the release end, really.
Yeah. So even though the release won't be until December 6th, or at least that's the target date, and those are usually never off by more than a day or two.
Actually, not far away. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I was gonna six say, weeks or something?
But it's still over a month.
I don't know.
But... Beta 1 is scheduled for October 26th, so
right.
Only bug fixes and documentation and stuff are acceptable after Beta 1. If you're going to try to get new features in from the normal track process, or if you're going to try to land feature projects, then that deadline just passed. So from the time, you have 2 months from the time the release starts, and you can merge those things. So that only gives feature projects about an 8-week window to do things, which usually includes at least a week or two of planning, and then also, you know, the all the processes that are involved, plus the pitches, the proposal itself. So, like, once you account for all of that, you really only have like a month of meat and potatoes types of feature development. So,
yeah, interesting. I think that's why, like, the feature project process is somewhat on the side of core releases. You know, you can carry on doing your feature project because there's not enough time to be like, okay, starting 4.7, let's start developing some feature projects. There's definitely not enough time to do that.
Yeah, and that started back in like 3.7, I think. So it was really interesting to see, but you still kind of have this momentum process. Because you could have a feature project that spans a lot of releases, but you really have to choose a release to say, like, this is going to be a big push for when we're actually going to try to get it into core. And when you do that, you get more eyeballs, you get more attention, and you still have a lot to do in that merge window. So the REST API, which has been under development for many years, it made an initial push in 4.5, 4.6 was kind of just a maintenance cycle, basically. And 4.7, there was a renewed push that both you and I were involved in you obviously much stronger than me as a member of that core team that did a lot of the development on the API. So there was a lot of activity over the last month or so for the API, and it got conditional approval at the last meeting. And then how long was it between conditional approval and
very small amount of time. So I think on Monday, late into the night, trying to pick back through this for me, and I think several others as well, the kind of first half of this week is a bit of a blur. So yeah, late Monday night, I think at from 9 till about midnight, then there was a core meeting to essentially kind of say yes or no to, I would say, kind of the REST API being a feature project. I think it was...
Oh, that's right. So the last Thursday, there was a discussion and the other features as projects were approved to go in. Yep. REST API got punted to a meeting on Monday.
Yeah.
And then the Monday meeting was when it got conditional approval, right?
Yeah. So there was...
But that meeting was late. That meeting was 8 p.m. or something.
That meeting, yeah, was, I think, 9 East Coast, and it went till about midnight. And then what we do is we came away from that meeting with a bunch of other things to do within the next 24 hours.
Yeah, so we created these five or six conditions for merge.
It was a nightmare.
That had to be completed within 2 days.
Yeah, so we scrambled, others put in more time than me, frankly. I mean, and I even feel like I'm pretty worn out.
Yeah. But Ryan, Kadam, Rachel, Daniel, y'all put in the meat of the...
Yeah, and then we also had some people doing work on trying some core features built off the REST API because the leads were kind of wanted, I guess, some evidence that core could benefit from this, so... Yeah.
Adam Silverstein did one of those.
Yeah, I think Josh Pollock as well.
Josh Pollock, Aaron Campbell, a few people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was a little bit of a new precedent for core projects. I also, one of the conditions was success metrics, which was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a post about trying to define what success metrics would look like, meaning looking at this project 2 releases from now and 3 releases from now and saying, how can we determine if this was a good move? And to my understanding, while it was pretty unique to the REST API so far, it's something that the core team would like to see with some future projects as well, to be able to these metrics are set in stone, but it's a good way to say this is what we expect and what our goal is for something to happen, and then to be able to look back on that and say this is what actually happened so that we can learn from that process when moving forward.
Yeah, I think a valuable thing to do, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I was running, I had essentially leeway to work with these numbers and basically just using my own history and knowledge of the project and WordPress itself to try to define them and then run them by various stakeholders to say, what do you think about this? And the pushback in different directions was really funny for me. Some people that said that I was being too ambitious and other people saying this isn't near ambitious enough. if this is all we get, then how is that possibly success? And
what are we aiming for to be successful? Do you have any?
Well, we kind of broke it down. I broke it down into 4 segments: plugin utilization, so distributed plugins, distributed theme utilization, custom development, so people that do client projects and stuff, and then core development. Which core development was probably the biggest one that played a role into the merge decision.
Mm-hmm.
The core team wanted to see the API and how it could play with core features and assisting with core features, replacing admin Ajax and other methods. So that was really interesting. In terms of plugins, it's really hard because there's 40, 50, 60,000 plugins, some sort of number. It was 47,000 plugins, like, I don't know, a year ago or 6 months ago. So I have no idea how many there are now. So you can't really measure off of that. You can't really measure just strictly off of like GitHub or whatever. Like that's too long tail because you can't analyze it. So what I decided to do was take plugins and break them into three categories: 1 million plus active installs, 200,000 plus active installs, and 100,000 plus active installs. And that ends up being around 250 plugins. And then I created a percentage for each of those levels of plugins that we would hope to see adopted. For themes, it's a little more complicated because it's a much slower process within the directory. So we tried to narrow that down to new theme submissions and whether or not they're utilizing the API in some way. That doesn't necessarily, actually, it does not mean a full website, like some kind of framework, like someone doing Twitter Bootstrap, but utilizes the API or something.
This is just like using it in any way.
Yeah, like maybe they're using it in the customizer somewhere or for a settings page or who knows what. And for that, we set a 2% adoption rate, which is kind of hard to quantify because you just don't know how many themes are going to go through that process. We also counted third-party theme shops, and there's some lists of like the top 200 theme shops. So that one's a little easier because we can just poll those theme shops and say, have you utilized the API? And if they say yes, then we say, okay, you know. But themes are just different than plugins because there's not feature development. It's more like, here's our new theme that does this. So it's a little harder to analyze. Custom development implementations was just straight up like client projects. And we set a goal of 50 plus because just because people build stuff with the API doesn't mean we'll be able to capture that. It's like the whole internet, the whole
like development. You're going to miss 90% presumably or something.
Right. You know? So the whole point is not really to say, oh, there are only 50. It's us being able to capture 50.
Right, right.
And be able to highlight them. So it's kind of like a showcase more than like that's all the projects there are. I anticipate that there'll be hundreds and hundreds of projects within the frame that we set. But if we can capture 50, then that's great. And then core development is, I think, the easiest one to track and possibly the most interesting. So we set a goal of 6 core features and 1 feature project that utilized the API. And I actually already heard from someone working on a feature project that they intend to use the API. So that's really cool.
Nice.
So yeah, that was the success metrics. And
how long do we have to kind of, when do we need to look at those again?
I figured I would look at them each release, and then I'm going to create some feedback forms basically that we can put on the API website so that people can self-report in addition to the areas where we can script it. And I actually think it'll be a little easier than some of the team was worried about because capturing data can be very difficult.
Yeah, sure.
But I have ideas for it. But basically 2 releases for some stuff and 3 releases for some other stuff. It's kind of how I broke it down.
Nice.
So 3 releases is a year. So we'll be able to look back a year from now and say, now what? Like, how did this compare? And you know, my guess is that some stuff we don't hit and other stuff we like far exceed. So you just never know.
Yeah. Sure.
If it's terrible metrics, then people can blame me. I'll fall on that sword. But that's just the metrics. What's more interesting to me is like we're going to break this down into multiple things. The API's journey, how core projects work in general. So we just introduced the timeline of a core project, but we'll get more into that. We're going to talk about what to know about the API now that it's in trunk and not a plugin. And obviously once it's not in trunk, once it's in the actual code base, it'll be on every website. And then what that means for the future of the API. So Briefly, give us a little bit of history on the API's journey, because I mean, some people are going to see this and be like, "What is it talking about? Version 2?" You know, like,
yeah,
this cool. Brand new API. So what the heck has been going on with this API?
The quick version is, I think, maybe 5 years ago, Ryan started the first first version of this, which was
Google Summer of Code project.
It was actually before that. So it was 6 months before that, or it was just before Christmas, I think, end of 2010. I think over, you know, a few days, I'd written a gist or a gist, however you like to pronounce that.
Surely it's a gist.
I think it's a gist. Of like 600 lines of like, you know, here's a REST API for WordPress kind of thing. And he was like, you know, I'll probably be done in a couple of days and, you know, maybe it pushes in.
As a side note, the commit that just went in was 20,000 lines.
Yeah, 21,000.
Half of that was unit tests, but half of it was the actual code base. So.
Yeah, no, so it's grown considerably over that time.
And that's just the endpoints. That's not the infrastructure.
Yeah, exactly. So that was about Christmas time. About 6 months later, he takes on as a Google Summer of Code project to flesh it out a bit more and then have it merged into core. That doesn't quite happen.
And I think the goal was WordPress 3.6.
Sounds about right.
It's a tweet that Nathan has joyfully brought up over and over again.
So I think from that, him and Rachel started working together sometime around the Google Summer of Code project on the version 1 of the REST API, you know, which was feature project to be merged in. Kind of reasons that didn't quite make it, difficult to kind of say, you know, it's quite a long time ago now, but my impression is that it didn't really have a lot. It wasn't very collaboratively developed, I guess, with the rest of the core team. So it was like quite a separate thing that not that many people knew much about. So when, you know, some people started getting involved, there was a lot of, I would say, like, the certain style it had for coding, I think, wasn't quite like super WordPressy, if like it's a little subjective, but it was like maybe a little magic in places, like, you know, the amount of the PHP function params that you defined were like automatically interpreted. And that was like the REST API interface there rather than like defining it. So it had kind of some magic stuff like that. And the code was like broadly, like it was all very good, but I'd say that it was quite fit for purpose rather than what we've got in V2 is more like an API to build APIs in a lot of sense. So it was more like what you would do if you were like, let's just add a REST API to WordPress like we have.
And you're going to use it for your own stuff and that's it.
Right. So when it came to doing version 2, then we looked at, I think, a lot more generally of like, people are going to want to, you know, the future is building REST APIs that's kind of like one one big part of the future anyway, at least, is, you know, people making all of their custom development stuff using REST APIs to do this and using that as the communication layer. Like, how do we build a system that can enable that? And also we'll build this WordPress REST API, you know, for the WordPress data on top of that. So that's really why I think V2 has taken so long, is because what it's kind of solving is the whole ecosystem around enabling people to build API driven things for custom development as well. And that has kind of required such a kind of fine-tooth comb, really, of like all of the code decisions and things like that need to be very flexible and kind of consider a lot of use cases, all the way from like, I just want to use jQuery to talk to my site to pull a post title, you know, all the way to the like, I want to build a whole custom API for like a back end of a Facebook competitor or something. So that kind of like broad spectrum, I think, you know, slowed the whole thing quite a lot because there was just a lot more consideration there. And there was a lot, like you say, I think it's, you know, 11 or something thousand lines of code just for those endpoints. And the infrastructure itself was like 4,000 or something like that, versus the original code was like much simpler than that.
Was the creation of or separation of the infrastructure from the endpoints part of? I know from going in a core perspective, it wasn't this, but in terms of doing it, structuring the project that way, is that part of that whole concept?
Yeah, absolutely. Like that wasn't just a way to get half of the REST API into WordPress. Like it had always been built version 2 in like two kind of levels of internal API, if you like. There was an infrastructure level to build APIs on top of, and then there was kind of like the WordPress's REST API, which could be, you know, sit alongside somebody else's plugin that they made to do REST API for their plugin or something. So that kind of strong divide was always there, and a lot of that work did go into the infrastructure originally. But even, you know, the WordPress REST API we have now with all of those endpoints that have just gone in have very good support, like first party support for custom post types, custom taxonomies, things like that. So this isn't just kind of enabling you access to your default content that we know a lot of information about posts and the fields that are available in the post. But you can create a custom post type. You can say it doesn't support, post content or whatever. And then when you get that in the API, it's not going to have any content. So like they're very flexible for all of those different use cases, again, which kind of the V1 didn't quite have that level of flexibility.
To what degree did Phil Sturgeon's APIs You Won't Hate book and community play a role in the architecture of the WordPress API?
It's a good question. I haven't personally read anything by him, but I know that it's Ryan is a very big fan, and I think like a lot of the design stuff came through Ryan, obviously in the beginning. But you know, Ryan has really been the spearhead for the architecture, and like he is broadly, the one along with Rachel that we kind of look to like really make the final decision on something, because there's so many, like even now I'm still kind of, when I'm contributing to the REST API, there's still a lot of decisions where it's like, oh, I could do it that way. Like there are merits to both, and you kind of got to work out what makes most sense to have like the nicer architecture that's going to work going forward. That's where I kind of like look to Ryan and Rachel really for like steering in that regard. And I think that's what they've kind of done with V2. And I'm like very impressed with that code base and the project and what you can do with it. The question is whether we can, enable everybody else also to be able to understand it maybe, and leverage it as to its full potential that I feel like I can, because I have such a good understanding of that code base. To me, it's like, oh my God, it's amazing to do anything. It's really easy. But that isn't necessarily the same for other people without all of that history. So I think one of the things we need to kind of focus on now is really putting the examples out there for those things, the documentation, helping people really be able to build stuff on that. Also, the idea that Core is going to hopefully use the REST API internally for a lot of its stuff. Again, with all of that development there, there's a good amount of just direction helping to do, I think, in making sure it's kind of used to its full potential, because it would be a shame, I think, for that not to happen.
Yeah, it's been really interesting for me as someone that does not even try to make claims about my knowledge of REST APIs. A lot of times I've seen talk about decision making around should we do this or should we do that, or how should we structure this, and there's these things that are inherent for API development, like whether the way you build something is actually RESTful and fits within those concepts, or there's like the self-discovery mechanisms that exist in this API, or like how standards, and like all these things, or like how something affects the schema or whatever. And these are, if you're just not familiar with these concepts in general, it may be a little confusing when you first start to work with the API. So I feel like it's important to like learn some of those concepts as people within the WordPress space, so that we can better understand the API and why certain decisions were made.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is like a lot of those more complex things, right, about like really understanding what is a RESTful architecture, or like how does this hypermedia thing work, or how do I auto discover what authentication is available. All of those things are kind of like, you don't need to do those. You can just, you know, copy paste a bit of code that says send a post request here. Where the kind of advantage comes from is like, once you understand what is a RESTful architecture, it's very easy to predict exactly what the REST API is going to do when you call it, or where the endpoints are going to be, and things like that. So like, and again, with the hypermedia stuff, understanding that, oh, there should be a link from here to here, and I can look that up dynamically. Like all of those things will just allow you to use the REST API, I think, to a higher level, really. But it's still quite easy at the more novice level, just as, you know, using most kind of APIs that people are going to be familiar with, you know, making a call.
I mean, there are just some things that, for instance, we got into this discussion the other day, and we'll move past this in a second, but I found it fascinating. So the other day we were talking about something that makes total sense in a WordPress context, which was querying all posts, no matter the post type. And you can't do that right now. There's not like a multi-post type endpoint or parameter. Mm-hmm. It'd be something that you create as a custom endpoint. But like, it's totally logical for people that are familiar with REST APIs. Like, that's not something that makes sense.
Sure.
But in a WordPress context, it's like, sure, it does. This is what you do within WP Query. And it's like,
yeah, that's very true. I think that's going to be definitely is going to be a learning point for a lot of people, is like the things that you've learned in WordPress and the things that are kind of considered the same in WordPress and things like that isn't necessarily 100% true for the REST API. I think, and that is a little tricky. And I think, you know, in the long run, it's better because of that. Because, you know, people learn, I'd say, like the inconsistencies of WordPress. And for them to not learn anything else, then that inconsistency would probably need to come over to the REST API as well. And that is definitely something that we haven't done. For example, you know, like the post title isn't post underscore title in the REST API. It's just the word title. And, you know, I can see that maybe I would say, like, we've steered WordPress in the REST API design a little more in the direction of kind of like theoretical consistency versus WordPress's typical 100% pragmatism, no theoretical advantage approach. And that is a little bit of a change. I don't think it's that major, but like I say, I think we've broadly still been as pragmatic as we can. But yeah, there's like all of those weird quirks that you've learned of WordPress, of like what things are named and, you know, WP underscore on some things and not WP. Like, we kind of like got rid of a lot of that stuff to try and make it, you know, pull WordPress to the right a little bit in terms of its consistency there. But hopefully, you know, we've not gone too far where like it's now foreign to use for WordPress developers.
And you're not trying to, the API doesn't try to do everything that a content management system might want to do. The other day I was playing with the API and trying to work some stuff out, and I realized, and I think this will be common for people using the API, they'll be like, oh, well, here's a function that I use in WordPress all the time, but getting that information in the API is a little more difficult. Why isn't this default in the API? Rachel was educating me, basically. But my scenario was, well, I want to get the source set, which is a newish feature in WordPress. Mm-hmm. Like, when you embed an image, it has the full source set of other size images within that same aspect ratio. Mm-hmm. And it's not a default in the API. You have all the information. Like, if you do the embed query parameter, it gives you like every image size, and you could go do all that yourself. But I was like, but yeah, we could change the core code base with like these five lines of code. And I went and did it, and boom, there you go. There's the source set. And Rachel was like, well, one, that's presentational. It's not informational. And also it's adding a lot of stuff to the response, which ends up making, you know, having additional consequences, and that's not really the type of thing we're trying to do. So that's the type of thing that you would actually do in your project, not in your, mm-hmm. not in the default API. So like trying to separate, like, this is what I do in WordPress and this is what the REST API gives you in terms of its responses. Those are very different and you have to think of them differently.
Yeah, and absolutely.
You have to do that stuff within your application and whatever it is you're building. And WordPress is one of those applications that you can utilize, but it's a great example of like how WordPress and the API aren't trying to give you exactly the same stuff. So every function in WordPress isn't going to be available with some endpoint or response from the REST API.
Yeah, I think that is a really good point. Like the REST API, I guess like the REST API is trying to be the best REST API that it can be. It's not really trying to be anything else. It's like,
I know you're not American, but that's like a total army slogan here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's like, be all that you can be in the army.
not intentional. So there are certain things, I guess, you know, like Rachel was saying in this case, that like philosophically don't really fit into that. And that can be frustrating because you can use the REST API for a lot of stuff. Like, let's say you're making a theme. Yes, you can put a lot of stuff, right? If you're used to WordPress themes, like the body class is a good example. Like that is something that in WordPress, you just type body class and you get all the classes depending on what data you're showing, all of that. That like piece of information doesn't really make sense in the context of a REST API, but it does still make sense in the context of a theme. So it can be difficult to kind of marry these two things, especially because right now we kind of only have the REST API component. So like body classes are really like a product of the routing and all of that stuff that is matched, which the REST API isn't solving. That's like another layer that, you know, probably needs to be built at some point, which is like a front end library for like handling routing and mapping that to the REST API. All of that kind of stuff doesn't exist yet. So if you're coming into this like, okay, time to write my theme on the REST API, you're going to be like missing all of these pieces probably because like WordPress theming has had, you know, 7 years or 8 years, like, of maturity to solve all of those different problems as well with different components and things like that. So though the REST API could be the perfect REST API, it's still not going to get you something like a body class to use in a theme. That's going to require other components and libraries and things like that for people to build on top. And we're kind of not, you know, unfortunately, we're not 100% there on everything to do that could be tangentially related to the REST API. This is kind of the milestone for getting that core piece. WordPress now is a REST API. We can now enable people to start building these blocks on top.
I think what that means, though, is there, I mean, because I totally ran into this, because one of my goals between like now that the commit is in and release is trying to give as many examples and kind of baseline setups as I can to help people that say, I'm ready to play with this REST API and get started. Now what do I do?
Yeah.
And you quickly realize like, oh, like you still have to learn, like know how to do all these things. And you still have to give the basis of a web application. And normally the basis of my web application is WordPress. Mm-hmm. So it's like this whole world that you have to discover. And you just mentioned several things like, what's the non-WordPress library for essentially front-end application management, you know?
Yeah.
And taking advantage, you want to take advantage of a lot of those things that WordPress does for us, but how do you do that in that context? So I think I want to ask you actually, what do you think that would look like? Will it be people that create like a plugin? So let's use a scenario, okay? So let's say we're going to rebuild PostStatus using the API, and it's going to be a web application built in, let's say just React. And you would still have like app.poststatus.com, which is a WordPress installation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same WordPress installation I have now, but I want the flexibility of a non-WordPress web application to do whatever I'm going to do. You have to handle those things like routing and all this information that you get from WordPress. Is somebody going to build a plugin, or is there going to be this whole atmosphere of like plugins that you install in the app, like the app.poststatus.com, and then that's going to be like a additional stuff you need to be able to make the best React app you can and take advantage of WordPress's built-in things? Like how would you say you see that moving forward?
I see it more being there being more tooling on the front end. you know,
on the React side.
React libraries rather than core thing. Like, it may make sense that there is, like, let's say somebody makes a React library for making like React powered applications on the WordPress REST API.
So to give people a little bit of insight there, right now, if you say, let's go create a basic React app, there's actually a thing called create React app, right?
Yeah.
And you just say npm install create React app or something like that.
Yeah.
And it gives you this foundational layer to create a React app. But that doesn't do anything for you in terms of WordPress. It just is a basic React app. So you would be adding another layer, another dependency layer there. And someone has to build a framework for the WordPressy stuff, right?
Yeah. Like, that's like one future I'm imagining. Like, it's perfectly possible to do everything, but like manually, as it were, right now. But I think there probably is room for some libraries to like help you out. So like in your React app, like maybe there's a bunch of components for just you know, display me a post, and then it will like automatically be able to find all the fields from the REST API and like plug those into your template and stuff like that. So that's where like I see like the front end stuff for like we're talking about web applications and theming type stuff specifically. I think there will want to be more libraries and stuff like that that are released to kind of bridge between the REST API and whatever chosen technology, I guess, on the front end. It's possible that there's also things that that a library like that could want from the app, which may include installing a plugin to add some more information into those REST API endpoints or add some new ones or something. That's certainly possible. But like if I had a month of free time right now to like develop the ecosystem of people working with the REST API, I'd be focusing on front-end tooling to allow you to use the REST API as easily as you could. And like I have been doing that to some degree with a couple of libraries already. But there's, I think, a lot more that could be done there. And I'm kind of hoping that, the development community kind of gets on board with that, with everybody sharing their stuff and you know, as you do. The kind of ecosystem for front end stuff is typically, there's a lot more sharing modules and things like that, which
kind of like the way underscores works, but now for all these other setups. The most thorough one that I've seen so far is by Moxie, and it's called the Lean Framework. So I'll put that in the show notes, and it's actually an Angular project, but it's got several built-in pieces of infrastructure for like page templates and some widgets and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that it's actually caught up to like the REST API that's going into core. I know, based on some feedback from me, they have updated to like using the version 2 of the plugin, using the built-in endpoints, but I don't know exactly how they do things on top of that, especially because it's only been a few weeks that, you know, like meta and settings and stuff has been in the API. So like there's a lot of catching up to do, and I think we'll see updates from Lean, but also new ones come about that help with that. But that's definitely going to be one of the kind of wake-up calls, I think, to people saying, oh, I'm excited about this. Let's go build a front-end website, but except for, wow, I have to now do stuff.
yeah, definitely. Like, I wouldn't like at this point rebuild your website on the REST API. It is a cool thing to do. I think you can learn a lot by doing that. But I don't think we're, definitely at this stage for theming, we're not saying, it's much easier to build your whole theme on the REST API. I would say like incorporating stuff from the REST API into your theme, a lot of stuff is a lot easier. If you want to build, infinite scroll or like dynamic content, like live reloading of posts, stuff like
that. I want to get more into those types of applications because I think that's what people really want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
But first, let's take a break because I want to thank our partner for this episode. Each week we like to give a shout out to one of the PostStatus partners, and this week it's Optin Monster. So Optin Monster You can go to optinmonster.com. It allows you to convert visitors into subscribers. You can A-B test lead capture forms. Don't need a developer. It is actually built fully on a pretty advanced API when they relaunched it. So now OptinMonster can be used on WordPress websites, but it can also be used on pretty much any type of website, including a website that you build using the WordPress REST API. It does not need WordPress to function. It's basically like one of those single line of JavaScript type of things that you can pop in there. This world has been under a lot of scrutiny recently because Google came out with new mobile friendly rules for pop-ups, is I think the way they phrased it. One of the reasons I've always liked OptinMonster is because it's not like a lot of the other pop-ups out there, where as soon as you land on the page, this pop-up comes up and you can't ever get rid of it. They've got a lot of interesting rules, and actually the pop-up version is only one of the things they do. So OptinMonster gives you all the tools and even the defaults to not be like a abuser of this type of lead capture. So they have light boxes, but they also have like the ones that are in the sidebar, little floating bars that are like on the bottom of your screen, straight up inline forms that don't do anything to obscure the main experience, little slide-in things. They have a lot of methods for doing lead capture, and they did a post recently that talked about what the rules are from Google and how it affects people that are using lead capture forms. And it's really educational, so that you can still have lead capture forms, but they're not like bad user experiences or against Google's new rules, which are fully in the whole purpose of them is to make better user experiences. So like with any tool, you could do OptinMonster in a way that is pretty gross for user experience, but that's actually not the way they do it by default. And it's, they have a lot of tools built in so that you can do impressive lead capture without all the nasty stuff. So that's why I invited OptinMonster to be a partner for PostStatus, because pop-ups and all these lead capture things, they've always been one of those things that's like, ugh, I hate it, but it works, you know? Yeah. And what I like about OptinMonster is they have a lot of stuff built into it to make it much more user-friendly when you're using it the right way. So I'm going to put that into the show notes so people can check it out, and check out OptinMonster at OptinMonster.com. Really happy to have them as PostStatus partner, and thank you to OptinMonster for being a partner. Okay, so use cases for the API. I think what people want to know is, what are some cool ways that I can use the API, like out of the box? Like, what's something that I can implement that uses the API that's not like a nightmare of getting started type of stuff, but is like maybe a instance where you can replace admin Ajax, maybe just something that you can kind of make your website a little better. What kind of ideas do you have?
Yeah, for like front-endy stuff. So like I was mentioning just before then, I think like enhancing your maybe quite static theme with a little, you know, level of
interaction,
updating stuff, things like that. Like the live updating posts, I think is a pretty cool thing. Like if you're looking at a list of posts and then you get a new one pop in, like as it happens, if you're like quite a, if you're a new site or something that is, you know, has quite
really active
high content. Yeah, exactly. Again, with that, like the infinite scroll stuff, like comments, again, like creating comments, seeing other people's comments coming in, like that kind of stuff, I see quite a lot of interesting areas.
So if it's like if you do like, I don't know, the Drudge Report or Hacker News or something, and you have a WordPress site that basically people keep as their homepage, then you could make it so someone could just automatically see new posts pop in as they are ready.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really cool.
Another one that's pretty obvious, I think, is like any search bar should just be like a live search bar that has like a drop down of results, rather than like doing it loading the whole new search page and all that kind of thing. Like that's super easy to do on the REST API. There's little reason why you can't do that, and you don't need any backing code or anything. All of the post endpoints and everything are there. You can search and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I have a presentation that's saved by Brian Richards, actually. He was talking about ways to use the REST API right now, and one of them was to hook into search results in your search bar and automatically pop up the, you know, five most relevant or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that was really cool, and it was like six lines of code or something. So one of the examples that I think of, and I want you to tell me if this is a good one, is like if you have a really complex, like say feature page, landing page or something, and maybe it's like a tabbed interface or something, instead of like having that query that has all that stuff immediately, what if you just show like the first one, whatever's at the active tab, and then you pull in the new posts as you click on each tab. So like, you know, like those magazine themes and stuff that were really popular for a long time. Mm-hmm. Could you have some kind of interface like that, that it just pulls in the post from the REST API as you kind of cross over those different categories or tabs or whatever?
Yeah, I think that is a like, there's a couple of advantages to doing something like that. One is like you get to actually live update the content when somebody clicks on rather than when they first load the page and leave it sitting there for ages. One is like it's quite good for performance, both for
initial page load.
Yeah, initial page load time. Also, like with WordPress, if you're going to be like loading five tabs with like 20 articles on each and they've all got images and stuff, like rendering that page for the server takes quite a lot of time. So it allows you to render it super quickly as well. Also, like maybe most people don't even bother clicking on those tabs, in which case you're wasting quite a lot of bandwidth and server resources and stuff. So it allows you to be a lot more piecemeal in like the information that you're going to show to the user right now. And then like you can be a little smart, maybe like when they hover over one of the tabs, you can start loading those posts in straight away or something to like get that time a little bit down. There's definitely things that you can do there. But being able to break, like seeing it less of just like one big blob that you're throwing at the user is your whole page content, including all of the stuff behind pop-ups when somebody clicks on something. Like pulling all of that out into different things is quite good, I think, for the user experience of getting them stuff quickly and the page generally kind of feeling a lot lighter because of that.
What would you say about like kind of a faceted search style implementation? Do you think that would be a good use
case? Yeah. I mean, that is possibly a good use case for, like you were saying, like some kind of, you know, more sharing of reusable components or something like that. Like a faceted search off of posts, like a reusable library to do that is something that probably could be quite broadly used because it's always using the same endpoints and all of that.
I was thinking of that because I have multiple content types, you know, so I've got like private notes and public posts and we've got podcast episodes, I've got directories and there's a lot of shared taxonomies between those. And I was thinking like, well, if somebody just wants to go on PostStatus and find something very specific, what if there was a page, like what if my search page wasn't searched by text, or what if on those results you search by text, but then it says like search just profiles or search just notes or something. And like you could filter down and use a faceted search. It seems like it'd be a really neat implementation of the API potentially.
Yeah, definitely.
Or an e-commerce scenario too would obviously be a good scenario for some kind of faceted filtering.
Yeah, and I think WooCommerce is kind of fleshing out its API from what I gather anyway. Like the first one was more an API to like be used in the admin for reporting and things, but I think they're kind of really going in the direction of being able to build front-end experience to, you know, have it much more dynamic in that regard, which I think is great for WooCommerce.
Yeah, that'll be really cool once they do that. A use case I was thinking of recently, and you can tell me whether it's stupid or not, was kind of replacing default profile editing. So if you have logged in users and you want them to edit their profile, or the other scenario that I considered was just essentially creating something that's kind of like a card. So like, if a member of PostStatus wanted to put their PostStatus profile on their website, or like just kind of use some kind of like canonical profile or something. And like, for some reason they use my website to do that. Like, and they can embed it anywhere. Is that a pretty good use case?
Yeah, actually I hadn't really thought about that one. That is pretty cool. Another thing I was thinking is like, or somewhat similar line is like having, like again, enhancing your theme with like hover cards for, I don't know if you, I think like Gravatar.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Gravatar has hover cards that I always turn off.
Right. So, but you could, I think, have a similar type thing, but for the, you know, post authors to show like their other posts on the site or something like that. So like using, you know, looking at the user information, see what you can do with that, the author information. But pulling that cross-site, I think, is pretty cool as well.
So a lot of contextual help type of scenarios or contextual information are basically anything where you could use Ajax, typically. Except
yeah,
now,
exactly. It's more like now you don't need to worry about the back-end side of that as well.
Because getting that information itself is now really simple.
Exactly, yeah.
Huh. Any others that I'm not thinking of that are fun use cases on the top of your head?
For the theming side, that's kind of like always on the top of my head. There's quite a lot on the admin side of things, I think, that can make, you know.
Sure, yeah, let's talk about it.
Make just like authoring content and like all of that kind of stuff. Like whenever you have to, I don't know, in WordPress, like there's quite a lot of areas in WordPress now where you're expected to type in a username, but it doesn't like give you autocomplete and stuff like that. Or like, you know, selecting a category ID or something. So like all of those type of things can really now easily be fleshed out, you know, to show the real data that's behind that. So you can much easier provide just like form UI, I think, which is a lot nicer because of that.
Are there scenarios in the admin that are performance hogs right now in order to show certain information, like say a comment count or something, where
you could kind of like load it after the fact or something?
Yeah, either load it after the fact or make it on demand type of information so that it doesn't bog down the initial query.
Yeah, like the way that Core works right now is just like how I was kind of mentioning before is just like it just like treats it as one massive page that's going to drop on you. And then like there's a couple of things that are like progressively enhanced with JavaScript after that. There may well be plenty of those things that can be loaded in after it's like quick editing right now. I think like that adds a good amount of chunk to the body weight just because you know, every post needs all of its editable information in the page body already.
Of the initial.
Yeah, exactly. When you're like
initial page load.
When you render that post list, then you're getting a lot of stuff.
Which is a ton of information. Like even the default quick edit has basically everything in the standard post table available.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So like there's a lot of stuff that could be a lot smarter with that. I think also like one thing that I really want to have at some point is like the list tables either use Ajax when you like use the pagination, so that's a lot faster, or even potentially infinite scrolling if that can get quick enough. Again, like live searching as you just type in the box, then the rows can disappear and appear. Like having all of that a lot more dynamic is going to be really nice, I think.
So when you consider a lot of several times over the past couple of years, there have been conversations about turning the WordPress admin into some kind of single page application. It seems like instead of like one, like in one go, it's like here's the admin as a single page application instead of what it is now. Would you instead imagine seeing that in like a very iterative way to where you turn specific actions into on-demand actions that are JavaScript driven rather than
rather than one page load or whatever.
Yeah. One that I was thinking of was just when I'm editing a post and I press like save draft, it drives me insane that it's a full page reload.
Oh yeah. There's like that the edit post form there is just like super slow. One thing that really annoys me is like clicking add post. Like even that page takes ages to load. And it's not even that. It's like, it's really junk. Like if that page is still loading, you're trying to scroll and like, it's so slow that it like locks your scroll and it's like, I don't know. It's horrible.
Yeah.
So like there's a lot of this that, yes, like we can do some surface level things like in the first instance, right? Which probably is what will happen. There'll be a few like select boxes that we change to like having live search and a few things like that. Like list table becoming fully dynamic based off the REST API is like a pretty difficult thing to do, especially because there's such like a strong PHP API that you also have to support because of the list table stuff. So that is like not going to be without its challenges, but that's kind of like the future that I see. I think, you know, I've kind of talked this before, but like the WordPress admin could improve a huge amount just in terms of performance and usability, but even like really keep the same design, but become like a true application, really, you know, within that design. That is kind of like what is interesting me so much about like the core's adoption use of core is like, yeah, people that are making new feature projects will already hopefully be able to start at like 30% of the way through because they've got the REST API to use already. And hopefully, you know, when they're building out features, they'll also build them into the REST API so other people can benefit from that as well. So there's that side of things. But all of the kind of like meatier, modifying the admin in a bit more of a fundamental way to better, you know, handle the REST API. So that could be something as crazy as like, yeah, like you say, you hit save draft on edit post and that just does a REST API request to do that, which is just like spins for a second and then it's done. Rather than the full page reload, full render, all of your meta boxes, again, lock up your browser kind of thing. However, like it's not going to be easy, but I think that is the future. I don't think it's incredibly unrealistic to see that like a lot of people can see the benefit of that. I think we kind of broadly know that just like rendering this massive page in PHP is not going to be competitive in the long run. So
in terms of WordPress and people's desire to use it.
Exactly. Exactly. Like people are going to get more and more used to using things and they feel instant on the web. There's like even the past couple of years has really had a really big push to try and, you know, be much better about that stuff, even with things just like critical rendering path and things. The admin right now is like, if you imagine that was like somebody's website as a theme, would be like an incredibly bad performing, bad optimized for performance type,
yeah,
type of website. So we should kind of look at it a little bit from like, rather than right now we kind of say like, yeah, the WordPress admin is slow and clunky, but that doesn't matter because it's only a small amount of people using that. Everybody's looking at the front end. Like that's not so much true. Like the more WordPress is used in big organizations and things like that, you've got literally hundreds of people using the admin to publish thousands of stories a day in one WordPress install. How do you kind of make the experience really good for those people? And I think the REST API is going to be a key part of that.
Mm-hmm. One of the applications that I always think about when I think about that concept is Basecamp. Obviously, for a hosted application like Basecamp, that was really important for them from the get-go because really the only interaction that users have with it is through the what you would call the admin or like the you know, the interaction layer. There's not like some read-only layer, like
view layer,
front end of a website. But when they built Basecamp 3, like it was all about speed. They knew in their hearts that what makes people like or dislike a project management app the most was speed, because there's nothing worse when you're doing, you know, the work you do in the day, like a content management system person, you know, whoever's interacting with it, or a project management system person, like you hate waiting 5 seconds on a page to load. So
you do, but I think a lot of people don't even realize that that is what they're hating. It's just like using this feels horrible. Yeah, it just sucks and it's not enjoyable. It's a little bit like, I don't know, I listened to some podcast recently about the design of houses and like people can
99% invisible.
Yeah, this
I'm
was
so glad you brought this up.
Right. So like
I spent an hour on McMansionHell.com.
So like you can look at a house and think like, I hate that house, but you don't necessarily know why. Like, so that's how I feel. Like maybe people using like a clunky, slow interface, like the WordPress admin is like, they just don't enjoy, like every time they're like, oh no, I've got to drop into the admin to do that. It's like, oh geez, don't, you know, sinking feeling. And people probably don't know that is because you're having to wait all this time and it's janky experience. Like they can pinpoint it, but I'm pretty sure that is the reason. Like speed is such an important thing for that. It makes everything feel so much more lightweight that, you know, I think we've got to focus on that.
Yeah, it's totally why. I listened to that same episode and I've been obsessed with, I read that blog for an hour yesterday. it's called McMansion Hell. And by the way, I'm going to link 99% Invisible in the show notes. And it's a WordPress website, and they actually have no page load, no full page reload when you do new URLs and stuff. So yeah, it's pretty nice. But it's a fantastic example because I totally agree with you. Like sometimes WordPress's bad rap is, I think, speed driven. It's not user interface. Like if you really talk to people about what's WordPress's big advantage, a lot of people will say the admin, but they're definitely not considering the speed of the admin when they talk about that. And I think one of the threats to WordPress is the slowness of the admin. So totally I love that.
Let's get on it. Let's fix it.
Yeah, let's fix it. So that's going to be a big impact on core in terms of the API being there. What else do we need to know in terms of the future of the API? Because the API, we didn't really do this in the beginning. This is the content API is kind of the way we framed it. And then there's a part two of the endpoints and maybe a three and four where the management side of things is still yet to come. So how do we differentiate between content and management, and what does that mean for what's next for the API as a feature project?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I'm trying to like work.
Do I need to help?
So the way that I think of those separation, and I know this isn't going to fall exactly what we've got at the moment, so that's how I'm trying to like work out a phrase.
Yeah.
So like, there is a difference between creating items in a database, right? And like the settings around those things that you're creating. So like, I kind of see it as, you know, the content is just like everything you pump into your database, like filling it up, you know.
Managing your content versus managing your website itself.
Yeah, exactly. So like, if you're wanting to change how many posts should show on your homepage, like that's a meta kind of thing, right? That you're changing. That's not the content itself, which is just like, you know, text, images, all that kind of stuff. So like we have focused mainly on WordPress's content in this round, which we've kind of called the content endpoints. But there's a lot of other things that you can do in your WordPress admin, which isn't around creating content. Like you can install plugins, you can change settings, you can, you know, configure your menus, though that may, you know, menus is maybe like on the edge of really, you know, that shows on your website, but it's not quite content in the same way that like content to me is something that like grows over time, whereas your menus on your website don't really grow over time.
And yeah, so I think it's the API team kind of separated it into the type of stuff you manage regularly versus the type of stuff that you manage once in a while. You can kind of talk about menus and widgets as content, except for it's really static. It's not something that you're changing all the time. So the content endpoints, you can still create an admin interface, custom admin interface where you're writing posts. Like if you look at the default WordPress app, really it doesn't have a lot of site management involved. It's just like write a new post or whatever. And that's basically what this iteration was focused on. What are the types of things that we're wanting to include in the future in terms of RESTful interfaces?
So, I mean, everything really, but specific ones. Menus definitely needs to happen. Widgets needs to happen, but it's a very difficult problem to solve.
Why is that difficult? We've said that a lot, but
yeah. So really what you're trying to do with REST API is like have semantic information. So like we kind of like tried to do with, you know, HTML several years ago, is like, instead of just having this big blob of like random bold tags, like let's use a strong tag to say like, what are the words with stronger emphasis? So it adds kind of like meaning to that content. So that's really what the REST API has to do throughout. It kind of needs to an understanding of like, this is the title of the content. This is the way that the content is related to other items. The problem with widgets is the way that they are built in WordPress is kind of as if like, you know, everything was just one blob of content. You don't really have any semantic understanding about any of that widget. So you create a widget as a developer that has like a title, an image, and some content or whatever. But the problem is WordPress doesn't really understand all of those things. You're just told to output a form and save the data. Like it doesn't really know what fields you're using necessarily and things like that. So when it comes to mapping a REST API onto that, it's then very difficult to pull out all of that semantic information.
And to be clear, if this was a read-only API, it'd be dead simple, right?
Yeah, that would be pretty easy because you could just...
basically get the options endpoint for widgets.
Yeah, you're pretty much like on a read-only endpoint, you're kind of getting the HTML for that widget, which isn't like that isn't even great because a REST API isn't really focused around like blobs of HTML. Like right. if you have a widget that technically has a title and then some content, like in the widget API, you just output that as a block of HTML. So the REST API can no longer say, you know, this is its title and this is its content, and your theme can then be like, okay, I want the titles at the top here and then I'm going to put the content below.
But if someone's only goal was to spit out widgets that you've already managed in the WordPress admin and you just want to put them on the front end in a like via grabbing information through the REST API, a read-only endpoint would do that. And that's not what makes widgets hard. What's making widgets hard is the fact that when people register widgets, they can register absolutely anything. And it's basically like this crazy territory of fields and data, and you have no idea what to expect, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like there's no declaration of different stuff there. There's no information you can glean from it apart from what the developer knew and they like implemented in this non-machine readable fashion. So really what widgets needs is some kind of API to be, is in an internal API to kind of like register widgets and say what their fields are and things like that. And that's kind
so of, fields API.
Well, yeah, exactly. So if that one comes to fruition, then that could be something that can help.
Why is that process for widgets different than Meta, which Meta was included in the content endpoints?
So Meta was a similar problem, but Meta is at least broken down into, you know, that things have a meta key and a meta value. So the amount of wrangling that we had to do there was a little less. You just need a developer to tell you, you know, I want to register a meta key and this is the types that it can be. And this is the validation that you should perform on that. So it's much more atomic units of information that you're dealing with. The problem with a widget is it usually is just a big conglomerate of different information. And so we have to do a similar thing to what we did with Meta. I think we've just got to do it like, you know, five times more kind of bigger problem to solve there.
What other priorities are there?
So there is plugins and themes and management is kind of... It's there. I don't think it's a big priority, frankly.
I actually did a 4.7 and 4.8 priorities list.
Mm-hmm.
And I did three. So we obviously are kind of to the point. We've already discussed most of the stuff that's in 4.7. For 4.8, the things that I have listed are additional core utilization opportunities, which we talked about. A multi-response endpoint, which was in response to people saying they want posts and pages. So determining whether that's the right path.
Mm-hmm.
And then also one that I'd like to get into is OAuth. We didn't include OAuth 1 in this round for 4.7. So is authentication one of those priorities?
Yeah, so
I guess you were talking about endpoints that would.
Yes. Yeah. So that like endpoints are quite an easy thing for us to work on now because the pattern is there. The content endpoints have been accepted into core. I don't think there's going to be much resistance on other endpoints that we're making. So that's why that's kind of like, there's just an easy path. We've just got to kind of like do that work, I think. But yeah, authentic.
When you say the pattern, if you look at the current code on endpoints, I can't get to GitHub right now, which is great.
Yeah, no, half the internet is down today.
Yeah.
I'm literally on this call and being like pinged by lots of people for like, for like the internet is down today. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it's everybody. It's not just you. But basically, if you look at the endpoints folder within the API code, there, if you look at like the post types controller, so there's a controller for a particular endpoint, and then the route is registered, there's the permissions check, you get the information, you prepare it, and then you send it back with a schema attached. And so like that's your endpoint. It's got certain bits that it returns the information and the schema with it, and then bam, there you go. And that's a structure that's repeated for posts and terms and users, et cetera. So that's the same kind of repetitive structure of future endpoints. So like menu items is a pretty good one to be able to compare that to, right?
Yeah. So menu items, I think, can like, most people can just kind of like work out, yeah, how to do that. Let's get it done kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So there will be several endpoints that will be relatively straightforward in terms of going in. But then there's stuff that's a lot less straightforward. So we talked about theme and plugin management, for instance. Like that might be a little more complex because you're talking about like WordPress site management interfaces.
Yeah. So like the REST API interface on that, like, yes, you can get a list of themes. You can get one like uploading a new theme. Like how do you do that through the REST API? Like how does upgrading a theme work? How do you like handle the upgraded theme, but it triggers a fatal error? Like all of those types of things like are going to be difficult for sure.
Mm-hmm. But those are all endpoints. That's what's being termed management endpoints. And those will work in the same way as the API to date has been, I assume. I guess it hadn't been totally settled, but probably there will be a plugin, whether it's the plugin that people currently have installed for the API, and it now just transitions to being a management API plugin, or if there's a new plugin for management endpoints, we don't really know yet, I guess, right?
We don't know. I think we'll go down the route of having new plugins, like the what is now.
Don't we kind of miss out on, you know, 50,000 installs or whatever it is?
We do, but do you want to like use cases? Shoehorn in that into 50,000 installs the people that didn't even know that's what they were getting when they just upgraded the plugin? I'd say
I do.
I know, yeah.
I want all those people that are using
it. As a developer, it's certainly a tempting.
It's a way better test bed.
Yeah, but I think what will happen is we haven't committed this yet, but core will deactivate the REST API plugin when you upgrade to 4.7. So we're not going to put anything in there that isn't in core. And then we will just release other plugins for those specific things, most likely.
For our listeners that are running Trunk and the API plugin, it currently will detect the fact that Trunk's got the API in it, and it'll be non-operational, but it'll still be active, right?
Yes.
I actually confirmed that on my own blog before I asked that question. It was a leading question. Because Ryan McHugh told me that's what would happen, but I didn't believe him, so I tested it.
Okay.
So yeah, you'll be fine if you have the plugin active and you run Trunk, which all of these people that are an hour into this podcast about the REST API, you should be running Trunk on something.
I hope. Well, yeah, I hope so. Well, at the same time, that's good.
Yeah. So the management API will be a different plugin or something, and that will be where development of these additional parts of...
Yeah, I would imagine at this point we would do each endpoint as a separate plugin probably and try and just like, you know, as soon as it's ready, then we'd get that one to go try get into core. I don't think I'm hoping, anyway, I don't think we should ever do something this big again. Like 20,000 lines of code. Like when was the last time 20,000 lines of code was committed to Trunk? I don't think that that is a great idea. I've never, like, in this iteration, we said, like, no, let's add the stuff that we have progressively. I think it should have been way more progressively even than this. So on the upcoming...
Not only was it 20,000 lines of code, it was 20,000 lines of code that there was about 6 hours between getting the thumbs up and having to put it in the core.
Yeah, it was ridiculously tight kind of a window there. We were, like, working in shifts to get that done. It was, like, I would say... Like, maybe we'll do a big postmortem after this on this feature project after 4.7. I think there are a lot of things that are not kind of ideal about this process. And I'm sure we'll kind of get a chance to discuss those in the future.
Cool. So we kind of know the priority list. Oh, we didn't talk about authentication. I want to talk quickly about authentication and then we'll put people out of their misery who are an hour and 10 minutes in.
So the like I said, all the endpoint stuff I think has a solid future there. The authentication thing, so just to bring everybody up to speed, we're not shipping any different authentication methods in 4.7, so it's still going to be cookie based or unauthenticated. So that means you can write to the API if you are doing it like on the site itself, so in the WordPress admin, on a theme, on maybe like a web app that you've built that you're hosting alongside your website. But you still cannot authenticate with Core with no plugins from, you know, just the command line locally or an iOS app or something like that.
So can we give an example? Can we use my example of, say, a PostStatus member wants to log in and update their profile?
Yeah.
I can just use cookie authentication for them to log in and then... they'll have write capabilities on their user.
Exactly. Yeah. They could.
That's authenticated. You know. And you can do that currently with no additional plugins.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
So, but if I have a iOS app for PostStatus and I want people to be able to log in through the iOS app, then I would really need something like OAuth 1.
Yeah. So I'm making this a Vienna app at the moment, right? Which is a iOS app to manage your WordPress site. Though the endpoints are in Core, I'm still going to have to require that users go and install the OAuth 1 plugin for them to be able to use this app. So I get to like strip down the amount of plugins a little bit that it requires somebody to have, because it used to be that you needed to have the REST API installed as well. Not need that anymore, which is really nice. So there is still like a ways to go on the authentication side of things. There's like... I'm not going to get deep into the authentication issues because, frankly, you know, it's going to go over most people's head and it's going to be boring. But the kind of there are some very difficult problems with WordPress being, you know, this distributed platform. Everybody has their own install and there isn't really much centralization. Like there is WordPress.org where people pull plugins and plugin updates are brought from. We've kind of got proposals to try and introduce also applications to be part of that. So you would have themes, plugins and applications, like, you know, on Facebook you have apps. However, Matt especially seems very kind of adverse to that idea.
That would be, applications would be something that are part of the WordPress.org ecosystem, the same way themes and plugins are distributed from there.
Yeah, so it would be, and that's
like kind a whole of, new layer of stuff to manage on WordPress.org.
Yeah. Like my thought is, like, I really like the sound of that. I think that's a fantastic, I think that fits in really well. Is like, yeah, you've got plugins and themes, which like you can install to your site if you want to change the functionality there. We've also got applications, which is for stuff that's built like on top of WordPress sites and things. And then you can, you know, add those to your sites to allow them or whatever. So I think it all works conceptually quite well, personally.
So the difference, real quickly, there's one scenario that helped make that clear for me. So the difference there between, say, having OAuth for my website versus being able to use WordPress.org as an authentication broker of sorts would be if someone's on YouTube and they click the share on WordPress button, then if WordPress is the broker, then WordPress is like the intermediary that makes it really simple for YouTube to talk to WordPress, WordPress to talk to my site, and bam.
Yeah.
Whereas... you're never going to have a share button on YouTube that says share on Brian's, like share on Brian's post. Like there's not a post status share button on YouTube.
Right. Exactly. That is what like having direct authentication kind of requires that, unless there's some other mechanism to do sharing. But in this scenario, I'm thinking YouTube, use the REST API to make a post on your site that they put the video in. That kind of direct authentication isn't going to be possible with a product like YouTube unless, Brian, you manage to really sweet talk somebody and get a post status button.
I'll talk to Sergi.
Then there needs to be some intermediary there. So I would say on this point quickly that there's been a lot of mention of like, oh, it's like centralization or WordPress isn't centralized. Like, this is no more centralization than WordPress. Every WordPress install every day sends a bunch of statistics about your site to WordPress.org. WordPress.org can arbitrarily push any code that it wants to your WordPress install for it to update to, for it to force a plugin update. Like, this centralization is already there completely.
Yeah.
And there's nothing, like, even I would say, like, the authentication stuff for the broker is even much less centralization than what we have with the plugins and updates, checks, and remote code changing. So, like, I think on one hand, like, people don't like to talk about that very much because it is a little bit weird how, like, WordPress is telling how many users it has in its database to WordPress.org. Like, does everybody actually realize that? Whatever. So maybe this will make that a little more prominent that, like, yeah, WordPress does phone home quite a lot, and it does have, like, does pull code from WordPress.org. It is a centralized authority. But I think, like, if you just accept that it already does that, then I don't really see how this is any different. And this can be, like, incredibly useful because of that. So this is kind of my gripe with, I don't really see the other side's argument incredibly well, I guess, because I'm not, you know, heavily agreeing with it. But it seems to me that, like, my current rationale for understanding why this doesn't want to be WordPress.org is it's like, no, we don't want to run that. It's going to be a nightmare to maintain. Which is, like, a valid argument, but in which case, like, I think we need to just address the problems with WordPress.org of why it's so difficult to set anything up on it. Because I see this...
But you could make the case that the current process of having plugins and themes on WordPress.org is a nightmare. I mean, it works, but it's, like, if you look at the variance between, like, the laissez-faire, almost do anything plugin ecosystem and the super tight, long delay theme ecosystem, like... Those are so different and distinct and managed on WordPress.org. Like, there's a case for saying, let's not get applications into that same, you know, potential landscape.
Right, but is anybody suggesting that we, like, remove themes and plugins because that is difficult? Like, the user experience is fantastic for plugins and themes right now compared to, like, having no registry at all. So, yes, it's kind of difficult to do that. Yes, there are problems with the current implementation and all of those things, but I think, like, if anything, we just want that to be better. We don't want to take that away. So I can understand that strategically right now, like, let's sort out the WordPress.org thing. Let's, like, you know, I don't know, get these systems set up a little bit better. But I see a fantastic opportunity for there to be a registry of third-party applications that use the REST API for people to really start using WordPress as a kind of... This is an API into 25% of the internet. Web, sorry.
Well, there's actually, I want to one potential note on that is plugins and themes. They're, what did I say, 60,000 plugins. Mm-hmm. The 25% of the web, each one of those could be an application. You know, so, like, it could end up quite possibly having millions of applications assigned on WordPress.org. So it is probably a different scale in terms of size, pure size of
things. Well, but you don't have a... I think it's the opposite, because you don't have an application per site. You have an application per developer that is making a service that can integrate with WordPress sites. I don't think... Like, sure, there is a future for quite many thousands of those. If that is as many of plugins, like, if it is, I think that's great, because that means the REST API is, like, very heavily used. Like, this is a new class of thing, of way to use WordPress. That is why I'm not sure why there is a lot of resistance to this. Like, we can build a third thing. We've got plugins and things. Like, we can build this whole new ecosystem of a way to utilize WordPress with people building on top of it rather than modifying it directly. That's why, like, I see that being a really interesting future, and why, like, the broker stuff is something that I'm really passionate about is, like, I see there just being, like, great potential there. And I kind of...
No, we have a... Actually, we should use that as an opportunity then, because we have a standing offer from Matt about wanting to be on the podcast. So maybe we can get him on and we can talk about WordPress.org.
Maybe. That would be good.
That'd be a lot of fun. I want to ask you one more question about Auth, because OAuth 1 has all the things that you need for a secure transaction built into it.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it a bigger internal application, whatever you call that, code base or whatever, than OAuth 2.
Yeah.
Where OAuth 2 relies on the web itself to manage the encryption. So OAuth 2 is restricted to HTTPS sites only. The question I have is, it to me, I'm fine with OAuth 1 and WordPress if it goes in, but between 4.7 being released on December 6th or whatever, and January 1st, I think, is when Google is going to start marking every Chrome website that doesn't have HTTPS with a big red exclamation point. So, like, yeah, that's going to start freaking people out 1 month after the REST API goes in. Like, are we really going to, like, when, at what point, like, what kind of dramatic shift are we going to see in January and February of websites in a mad rush to enable HTTPS so that they don't have this big green arrow? Like, the growth curve right now on Let's Encrypt went from, like, I don't know, 5 million to 10 million in no time. Like, there's a huge spike just the other day, even. Some host must have auto-installed it. So, like, what should we expect in terms of HTTPS on websites? And is it worth considering just skipping OAuth 1 and shipping OAuth 2 with Core, but maybe wait a year or whenever, like, 90% of websites or something are HTTPS?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's still to be seen, like, how quickly that HTTPS is adopted.
I realize I'm asking you to predict the adoption.
No, but
of HTTPS.
To be honest, I think to my answer, it doesn't really matter too much. So, OAuth 2 isn't that difficult easier than OAuth 1. Like, you don't just write an OAuth 2 flow manually. You still use a library to do that. So, yes, there is, like, a little bit more code, but, like, in truth, there's not a lot of code to generating those signatures. Like, it's very complicated, and it's very finicky. You have to do things in the exact order. You've got to make sure you're encoding things exactly right, like in the library implementation. So that is a difficult thing, and that is what SSL is, like, offloading for you. There are many other security benefits, obviously, of HTTPS as well. So I think that it is fantastic. Everybody should totally use it. But in terms of, like, comparing the OAuth 1 plugin to an OAuth 2 plugin that we might make, there isn't really much difference in those two things. So I don't think there is an argument from, like, let's go with HTTP 2 because it's easier for us to implement. I also don't think that it's that much easier for client developers also to implement because they need to use the library for both of them anyway. Like, a lot of people say, oh, OAuth 2 is loads easier. But that's usually just because, like, the OAuth 2 libraries they've used are good and the OAuth 1 library used is kind of crappy. I think just because of, like, more modern APIs use HTTPS because they're centralized, they can do that. And then for, they have a OAuth 2 library, it's a modern, nice library. They enjoy that. So I think there's a little bit of correlation. So I don't think the disparity is really big. And because I don't think that's really big, like, even if 50% of the web is using HTTPS by March of next year, which, by the way, like, even at its current growth curve, I really cannot see that happening. Even if it gets to those kind of numbers, I'm still not sure that outweighs the, like, we can include the other 50% by enabling, by using OAuth 1.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of, like, don't really see there being a huge divide between these two things, in which case let's just, like, include everybody and bring everybody on board. Like, maybe there's an argument for, like, oh, maybe this will make even more people upgrade to HTTPS.
Yeah, we don't ever take that stance with
exactly, like, we're still using PHP 5.2 because there's, like, 3% of users there, so by that logic, like, we should go way out of our way to make sure everybody on HTTP, because, like, PHP 5.2 is very insecure, all those other problems, but we're still treating the user there as you know, comes first. So we should definitely do that as well for authentication.
Okay, that's a good argument. You sold me.
Actually, you managed to get a OAuth 1 running, right, and make some authenticator requests.
Yeah.
I'm interested how difficult that was for you.
The verbiage and the steps was not particularly well documented.
Mm-hmm.
The knowing where to jump and all that kind of stuff was a little challenging. But once I got through that, and that can be resolved with some good documentation, then I felt like it was actually relatively straightforward. And from a user perspective, once you have it going and like if you're using it and you just have some need for it, from a user perspective, I didn't think it was that bad. It felt familiar to me because anyone that uses Twitter or Facebook or anything else that has an authentication step, you say, yes, I approve, Google Docs to access whatever. That step is pretty normal, and as a user, I felt comfortable with that. So to me, I think there are definitely some gaps for OAuth 1. Like I think I'm glad that it wasn't included in this batch.
Mm.
I think it's easy enough to clean up between now and 4.8 to where it can go in 4.8, or it should go in 4.8 and be ready to go so that people can have that available to them.
Yeah, no, I'm like, the reason why like I don't have authentication on the top of my mind right now is like, I know there is a lot of heated discussion ahead there. And like right now I've just gone through like a couple of years of that with the REST API. So like I'm happy
taking a break.
Yeah. I'm happy to take a break. Like let's focus on these content endpoints. Authentication like is a lot more, almost a lot more opinionated. There's a lot more opinions involved and like the right way to do these things. So that I'm kind of just like leaving for next cycle to like worry about that right now, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely introducing some relatively confusing concepts to people, like tokens and secret keys and things that it can be pretty scary if someone is trying to set this up, because it's probably not like your average site user. They're probably using something that requires it and they want to enable support, they want to use Vienna on their website or whatever, or there's an app wrapper. So they bought an app for their site that their customers can use, but they have to enable all this and make mm-hmm. it work. So like they're not the developer per se with a significant understanding of how OAuth works, but they're required to do the implementation.
Right.
That's the type of people that we have to account for.
Yeah, and I
make
hope
sure that
kind
they're
of
setting it up well.
In between now and something going into core, whether it's OAuth 1 or whatever, it's certainly, we need to get to the point where, you want to integrate with Facebook, you drop in this one JavaScript file and you call fbsdk.login. Like it needs to get that easy with all of the tooling around this. Definitely agree that even with, what you did, you were probably exposed to more terms and jargon than was necessary. I really hope that we can get to that level, and that's certainly going to be kind of the required level for anything to ship into core, is it definitely needs to be that easy.
Yeah, I was definitely a little concerned about the jargon that I saw because it was, I can't even remember now, but it's like
consumer secrets and all of this.
Yeah, and that those definitions have to be so specific. Yeah. If you call it like a consumer secret or a secret key or...
Yeah, no, if you're like, I can use them quite interchangeably because I know like if I say secret, well, it can only mean one of these couple of things. But if you don't know that and you're just like trying to Google this jargon, then it doesn't help that we're inconsistently calling something a secret key versus a consumer secret or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're setting those up, they need to be pretty identical so that you don't feel scared that you're mm-hmm. putting the wrong thing in the field and
right.
exposing your whole website to the boogeyman. That's all I got to say about that. We are legit maybe having the longest podcast we've done.
just accept
we've
it.
Got to get out of here. We shouldn't be surprised because it's a podcast about the REST API and the culmination of several years worth of discussion and talking on the podcast. This episode of the podcast was a drinking game. So
yeah, I got to say when this was merged in, I was so relieved. Like I just had this like,
yeah,
you know, well, I mean, we'll see if it actually ships in 4.7. Of course, we didn't have that conversation.
I asked you on Twitter what we should talk about this week on the podcast as a joke, and you didn't respond to me. So,
when did you do that?
The other day, you were busy merging. The API, or maybe celebrating.
I'll celebrate when 4.7 is released. No, no.
Yeah, true. Congratulations so far to everybody that was involved in this. Ryan McHugh and Rachel Baker definitely put in
stellar
lots and lots of work for a very long time. So good job on them. You and Daniel as well. Someone that I think deserves a significant shout out this round. It would not have gone in 4.7 without them is Kadam White.
Yeah, absolutely.
Boku gave him some dedicated time, and man,
both
from a code and project management standpoint, he just went bazinga on this release and went the extra mile, and it was pretty incredible. So people that are happy the API is in 4.7 need to give him a pat on the back as well.
Buy him a beer.
Buy him a beer. And not the only ones. Like, there are some hard working type of folks that are in the REST API channel that just have knocked out a lot of bugs.
Yeah, no, we've had a huge amount of help this push, which has been invaluable, really. Just so many people to just kind of like help out wherever they can and stuff like that. It's been great.
I think 150 people got props on the commit.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So pretty cool. Good job, everybody. I think it's going to be really exciting for WordPress. We'll see exactly how it pans out. But I think it's a big step for WordPress, and we'll see where it goes from here. But it's very impressive. I'm happy to see it. I think it's an important thing for the project, and for a lot of reasons that we'll probably keep talking about. But keep an eye on it. Nothing's final until it's final. So WordPress 4.7 is released on December 6th ish. That's when it'll be for real. But the commit is in, so that's cool.
Upgrade to Trunk and test it out.
Yeah, go install Trunk. There's a beta testing plugin that you can get to the latest nightlies on, and you can see it for yourself. Go to your domain /wp-json, and that'll be the base level.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, follow Joe on Twitter.
Joe underscore Hoyle. No great tweets this week. I'm sorry to disappoint anybody that might have followed me in the meantime.
Yeah, that's okay. We talked about McMansionHell.com. That's our blog of the week. That episode of 99% Invisible is really good. And I've looked at every house I walk by in the past couple of days because of it.
are you now seeing horrible things that are making?
Well, my neighborhood's pretty old, so it's mostly like kind of older classic architecture, but definitely see it in some of the like more suburban type of neighborhoods. Go to poststatus.com for more of that, and go to poststatus.com/publish. The speaker schedule is going to be on the website soon.
Ooh,
for
exciting.
The Publish conference, which is December 1st. A day of rest.hm. Siobhan's going to be mad at us because I waited 96 minutes to talk about it. Now that the...
Oh, actually, API now it's in, though. I wrote my talk description. So that is the milestone for this week.
Nice. So go to a day of rest.hm. Check that out. Buy a ticket to a day of rest to join us in Boston. We will see y'all next time. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.